Okay, John chapter 18. We're going to pick up on around verse, maybe we finished at verse 27. We looked at last week Peter's denial of Jesus. Really, the chapter kind of divides itself into three people groups, if I can put it that way. The first third that we looked at 2 weeks ago was about Jesus, about how he has set his face like a flint. He's laying down his life. He's walking into the death, knowing what it is. And then last week, we looked at the second third, which is Peter's response, how he's following afar off, and then he ends up denying Jesus three times. This week, I want to look at the unbelievers part of the side of the story, the Jewish here, mostly the Jewish unbelievers. We see a little bit of Pilate here. We'll see some of the Roman side, but these people that hate Jesus, their part in all of this. You've got Jesus' part, you've got his followers who forsook him, and then you've got these people that just hate him and continue to hate him to this day. They don't know Jesus. The Bible indicates that the reason in the book of Acts, powerful sermons, and we'll reference it maybe once or twice in the sermon this morning, but the two sermons that were given early in the book of Acts, one was by Peter, the other was by Stephen. They point out things about these people that they hated Jesus, they crucified him unjustly. And one thing that they mention, I think it was in Peter's sermon, that he mentions this, is that you didn't know who he was. If you knew that he was the King of Glory, you would not have crucified him. But they didn't believe that. They rejected that. And because of that, they've got this antagonism against them. So let's pick up. Let's actually go ahead and read the rest of the chapter. John 18, let's pick it up in verse 28, and we'll read through the end of the chapter. It says, "Then led they Jesus from Caiaphas unto the hall of judgment, and it was early. And they themselves went not into the judgment hall, lest they should be defiled, but that they might eat the Passover. Pilate then went out unto them and said, What accusation bring ye against this man? They answered and said unto him," you can kind of hear the hesitation, they don't have an accusation. So what did this guy do? And they, well, if he were not a mouth actor, we would not have delivered him up unto thee. So he's guilty, okay? Just take our word for it. Verse 31. "Then said Pilate unto them, Take ye him, and judge him according to your law. The Jews therefore said unto him, It is not lawful for us to put any man to death, that the saying of Jesus might be fulfilled, which he spake, signifying what death he should die." I'm trying to decide whether or not to give any quick commentary along the way, lest we don't come back to some of these verses. But remember when Jesus said, If I be lifted up from the earth, I will draw all men unto me. Two times in the book of John, he mentions being lifted up. And that's the prophecy of the crucifixion. The Jews could never crucify anyone. Only the Romans could. And so for this to be fulfilled, the Jews could not have physically killed Jesus. The Romans had to do it. So anyway, that when the Jews say we couldn't kill Jesus, we're not allowed to put him to death. We'll talk more about that. When they say that, they have to hand him over to Rome to kill him. And that's the only way that crucifixion is enacted. Okay. Verse 33, "Then Pilate entered into the judgment hall again and called Jesus and said unto him, Art thou the King of the Jews? Jesus answered him, Sayest thou this thing of thyself, or did others tell it thee of me? Pilate answered, Am I a Jew? Thine own nation and the chief priests have delivered thee unto me. What hast thou done? Jesus answered, My kingdom is not of this world. If my kingdom were of this world, then would my servants fight, that I should not be delivered to the Jews. But now is my kingdom not from hence. Pilate therefore said unto him, Art thou a king then? Jesus answered, Thou sayest that I am a king. To this end was I born, and for this cause came I into the world, that I should bear witness unto the truth. Everyone that is of the truth heareth my voice." By the way, I think he says it that way. Obviously, he is a king. He's the king of the universe. I think by saying it this way, he's saying, I did not come this time around to be king, to set up my kingdom. I came to bear witness to the truth. Later, I'll come back and I'll be king. And he is already the king. But his focus right now is not on his kingdom, being the king. Verse 38, "Pilate saith unto him, What is truth? And when he had said this, he went out again unto the Jews and saith unto them, I find in him no fault at all. But ye have a custom that I should release unto you one at the Passover. Will ye therefore that I release unto you the King of the Jews? Then cried they all again, saying, not this man, but Barabbas. Now, Barabbas was a robber. And so, by the way, it says in, when you put the other gospel accounts together, he was a robber. In other accounts, it says that he was also a murderer and that he was part of the insurrection, this uprising against Rome. And he had committed murder in the insurrection when he was trying to lead people away from servitude to Rome. So that was Barabbas. He was a robber, but also a murderer. Okay, let's back up to verse 28. We see that Jesus, Peter denies Jesus, and then they lead Jesus from Caiaphas unto the hall of judgment. If you back up a little bit earlier, he went first to Annas. Let's see where. Verse 13. They led him away to Annas first, for he was father-in-law to Caiaphas, which was the high priest that same year. And then Annas sends him over to Caiaphas. We'll talk more about those details. So we pick up Jesus this morning there with Caiaphas. Many times people in life have a deep-seated commitment to something, and it's a little bit misguided or severely misguided. One time I remember meeting a guy that had achieved a black belt in whatever his particular study was. I don't know if it was judo or kung fu or karate or whatever. But one of the requirements, and I don't know if this requirement is across the board, one of the things, he had done everything, accomplished everything, except one thing, he had not yet accomplished doing the splits, which he had to be able to do in order to be the black belt in this. So, and he's probably mid-40s, late-40s at this point in his life, and not as limber as he used to be. And he's tried and tried, and he's exercised, and he's stretched, and he just can't get there. But he's got to get this black belt. So, here's what he does. He gets a couple of friends to help him. And he gets it down about as low as he can get, and he says, "When I give the signal, I want both of you to jump on one leg each." And so he does, and he goes down, and he accomplishes it. He had medical repercussions afterwards, but he got the splits, and he got his black belt. And I look at that and say, if that's what I have to do, I think I'll live my life without a black belt. I think I'll just, I'll steer into some other direction. But he was committed. He was willing to risk his health. He was willing to risk, long-term physical capabilities. And I don't know how he is today. But... But he was willing to go as far as he needed to accomplish this in his life. And many times people in life are dead set on something and they're willing to go to great lengths, whether it's even right or not. Here's an interesting verse in the book of Proverbs, chapter 4, verses 14 through 16. It says, "Enter not into the path of the wicked and go not in the way of evil men. Avoid it, pass not by it, turn from it and pass away. For they sleep not, except they have done mischief, and their sleep is taken away unless they cause some to fall." It's an interesting dynamic, isn't it? There are some people in life that they live to sin. They live to cause somebody else to fall. They live to have gain at someone else's expense. And it says that they don't even go to sleep at night. It only gives a picture that they go to bed, they put their head down. "Oh, wait, I haven't harmed anyone today. I need to go out and do something wicked before I go to bed." It's so ingrained in them, they'll go to great lengths to get whatever they can out of life. And we find that dynamic here in John 18 with these people that hate Jesus. It really is ironic that these people, the Jewish leaders, one of the things that they prided themselves on was fairness, equity, and justice in their judicial system. They had safeguards in place. A phrase that you hear a couple times is the council. Jesus was led to the council. The council was talking about a group of men called the Sanhedrin. And there were lower Sanhedrins, like city councils type things all over Israel. And then there was the great Sanhedrin, which was in Jerusalem. The lower ones typically had 23 people because you had to have at least 10 people to accomplish something, a verdict of at least 10 people. So you had to have 20 so that at least 10 could, and then you had to have a majority so that, And on top of that, you had to have a couple of extra people so that, you know, to accomplish different things. It all boiled down to 23 was their perfect number. That way you could always have an odd number so that every vote could not end in a tie. And they had to have enough people to constitute a quorum at all times with any vote. So 23 people. And then they had the great Sanhedrin, which was 70 people, included the high priest. And so and they had a lot of safeguards and laws that were built into their system. Some of them we get straight from the Bible. They got straight from the Bible. And some of them were added later, and they weren't, and we'll talk about some of them, they weren't bad laws. They were good. And in fact, much of our legal system today is drawn from the Judeo-judicial system. Yeah, I've never heard anyone say Judeo-judicial, but don't say that five times fast. But we get a lot of our laws from the Bible, biblical principles and that were in their society. And we'll talk about some of the things that they guaranteed. And they prided themselves in being fair and upright and always getting the right decision and making safeguards so that if they were almost on the verge of making the wrong decision, they could fix it before it happened. And this was what God commanded them to be. Let me, if you want to turn here and look at it, Deuteronomy 16, verses 18 through 20. This is what God commanded Israel. As they're setting up their laws, as he's giving them their laws, he wants to make sure that they're just and righteous and fair. And this is God's command for them. Deuteronomy 16, verse 18 says, "Judges and officers shalt thou make thee in all thy gates, which the Lord thy God giveth thee, throughout thy tribes. And they shall judge the people with just judgment. Thou shalt not wrest or twist judgment. Thou shalt not respect persons, neither take a gift. For a gift doth blind the eyes of the wise and pervert the words of the righteous. That which is altogether just shalt thou follow, that thou mayest live and inherit the land which the Lord thy God giveth thee." So that was God's command to them, and they tried to enact that. And they prided themselves that they were the most just judicial system around. You know, they were fair. And they threw all that out the window on this night when Jesus is betrayed. There were many ways that they went against God's word as well as the law of the land that they had set up for safeguards. Let me mention some of the things that the Sanhedrin guaranteed when somebody was accused of wrong, things that were guarantees to them. Number one, they were guaranteed a public trial. And as we walk through these real fast, we'll mention how every single one of these was thrown out the window and violated on this night when they accused Jesus and convicted him. So everyone was guaranteed a public trial. You couldn't just do it in secret. You couldn't do it without people around. And that's one of the things that they do. They did not have a public trial. They had a couple of things that seemed public, but the first ones where they're establishing what they're accusing him of were private. Number two, they guaranteed that somebody could have a self-defense. They could have someone to speak on their behalf so that they were not just left by themselves. Jesus was not afforded that. He was not given someone kind of a defense lawyer, so to speak. We have this in our society today. Everyone has the right to a legal defense. And they provided that as well, but they ignored that on this night. Number three, and this is one that's drawn from the Bible, is that nobody could be proven guilty by one witness. There had to be two or three witnesses that agreed. And by the way, the witness could not be the person themselves. They could not incriminate themselves. We see that in our society today. Somebody can plead the fifth and they don't have to incriminate themselves by their own speech. Even if somebody in their society would just volunteer, turn themselves in and say, "I murdered so-and-so," they couldn't just execute him on his testimony alone. They had to find someone else to verify that. They had to have at least two witnesses other than the person himself. And that was another thing that was broken. We'll look at the witnesses that they called later. Number four, the death penalty could never be enacted on the spot, on the same day. It was always to be enacted on the third day. This is a really interesting point. We'll talk about their hypocrisy later on, these Jewish leaders. The death penalty could never be enacted on the same day. It would always be enacted on the third day, meaning the day that they've come to their sentence, this guy's guilty, he's a murderer, whatever, he's guilty of death. That was day one. Day two was spent by everyone that was involved, the judges, the defense lawyers, people that were verifying whether this guy's guilty or not. The entire second day was spent trying to make sure that this was the truth. And everyone had to fast. No one was allowed to eat or drink anything all day because the matter at hand was making sure that this guy that we've pronounced guilty of death, we got to make sure that he's worthy of it before we kill an innocent man. So day two was spent in nothing but that case. And then the third day, they would wake up again and verify. And by the way, if anyone, you know, they have the quorum, had to be a majority vote. If somebody voted that he is guilty, he could change his mind on the third day and say, more evidence has come and I see that this guy is innocent. They could not go from innocent to guilty. If a judge on the day one gave an innocent vote, he could not change his vote to guilty. They really had safeguards set up from a mercy standpoint so that they never killed the wrong guy. But on the third day, it's established. Now they could pronounce that this guy is guilty and execute him. And here's what they did. The judges would sit at the judicial hall, and the guy would go out in a processional of the people that were going to kill him. By the way, the witnesses who condemned him to death, who gave the testimony, they were the first ones to cast the stone. They were the very first ones to perform the execution. And then the other people as well. But as they led him out, there were two guys that had a flag. One guy would be at the door of the judicial hall, and he would stand with a flag. And a guy on horse would follow the procession. And if along the way somebody changed their mind and said, okay, I lied about this guy, he's actually innocent, at any moment, the second person with the flag on horseback could wave the flag, and the person at the judicial hall would see the flag and wave his flag and say, stop it right now. Don't kill the guy. They had this set up to make sure, all these double checks and triple checks, to make sure they never killed the wrong person. The Sanhedrin was known as a very merciful organization, group. They didn't just flippantly hand out death sentences and kill them. Now, when they handed out the death sentences, they did kill them on the third day. They didn't have a 17-year death row like we have in our society, where taxpayers pay to keep the guy alive for however long. You know, it was firmly established. But once it was firmly established, they went out and they executed the guy. Here's an interesting thing. The day after they condemned Jesus was the Passover. And what's the Passover? It's this big feast where everyone eats. They were not allowed to condemn someone to death on this day and then fast on the next day. They would be breaking God's law by fasting on the Passover. Everyone had to partake of the Passover. So it was illegal for them to condemn Jesus to death on this day at all. They would have to be fasting the next day. And so to make sure that they could fast the next day, they just went ahead and killed him on this day. You know, so they're totally throwing their laws out the window. But that was one thing that they had said in their laws. The death penalty could not be enacted until the third day. And they did it on day one. They just ignored that law. Here's another thing, number five. The judges, the Sanhedrin, could never originate charges. They could only investigate charges that someone else were to bring. You could never bring someone in and the judge kind of go, and this is what they did with Jesus, the judges kind of go fishing and try to ask Jesus questions, figure out something that they can lay in as an accusation. There had to already be an accusation from outside, and then the Sanhedrin were to investigate that. They could never originate charges. Number six, the trial could only occur, their trials could only occur in the Hall of Judgment. They could not have trials some other location. And they did this twice, by the way, with Jesus, in the house of Annas and the house of Caiaphas. We'll talk about that in just a minute. But they threw this one out as well. And then number seven, the trial could only be held in the daytime. You could not have a middle of the night trial. And so several things here, those are seven things that they broke that were set up in their judicial system. But their number one concern is getting the death penalty for Jesus any way we can get it. We're willing to bend the laws. We're willing to throw the laws out. We're willing to ignore the Bible, the scriptures. There was a Jewish side to these trials and there was a Roman side. Here's why. I've already hinted at this, but the Jews were not allowed to kill anyone. They wanted a death penalty. By the way, here's kind of a way to think about it. Okay, we've got Jesus. We've been trying to find a way to capture him without the people knowing about it. Now we've got him, and we've got a sentence. We've got the death penalty, but now we just need an accusation to go along with the sentence. You know, that's what's going on here. And so there was a Jewish side and a Roman side. The Jews were not allowed to put anyone to death because they're under Roman occupation. And Rome has come in. Rome is the ruler of the day, Caesar. And Rome has said, you guys are not allowed to put anyone to death. Only we're allowed to put someone to death. So here's what the Jews have to do. They have to condemn Jesus. He hasn't broken any Roman laws. So they have to find that Jesus has broken one of their laws. And then they have to convince Rome that that's a good enough offense for them to kill him. And it's a stretch. And the way they do it is that they pressure Pilate. We'll talk about that. So here are the six. There were three trials on the Jewish side and three trials on the Roman side. First of all, we looked at this in John 18. We see Jesus taken to Annas and taken to his house. They led Jesus over to Annas. I don't know if I'm sure they didn't wake him up. I'm sure he's got this whole thing. By the way, Annas is the one who is orchestrating all of this. Who is Annas? Annas is not the current high priest. It still calls him the high priest, but he was the high priest about 20 years ago. But Rome was in charge, and Annas is the high priest, and he's a charismatic guy. He's getting too much power, so Rome steps in and removes him from being high priest. So somebody else has got to be high priest. So he appoints one of his sons to be high priest. And Annas has five sons and one son-in-law. Caiaphas is his son-in-law, his daughter's son, his daughter's husband. And by now, Caiaphas' son is the high priest. But before that, if I read it correctly, all five of Annas' sons were the high priest consecutively, and then Caiaphas. And by the way, in the Bible, you don't even see this. In the Bible, God said that the high priest is to be anointed, and he's to be the high priest until his death. But now the high priest has become this political office that can be bought and sold and shifted around. And so Annas is not still the high priest, but they call him the high priest in the same way that we call President Bush, President Bush. You know, once you're president, you call you president for life. So Annas is not the high priest, but he's still, if I can put it this way, he's kind of the mafia mob boss. And he's still running things from behind the scenes. It's literally like this. The high priest is a desecration at this point. We see a couple things that Annas would do. Remember early in the book of John, it talks about Jesus going into the temple and cleansing the temple, overturning the money changers' tables and driving people out. He did this first thing in his ministry, and he did it a week before he's crucified here. All of these goings-on were called the Bazaar of Annas. That's what it was known as by the Jews. This was called the Bazaar of Annas. Annas was the one who set all this up. So what would he set up? There were two ways that he would get money out of people in a stealing way. Remember, Jesus says, "You've made my Father's house into a den of thieves." And they all called it Annas' Bazaar, and Jesus is publicly saying Annas and his cronies are a bunch of thieves. So you can see why Annas doesn't like Jesus. He's coming in and he's cutting off the money supply. There were two ways that when people would come, and by the way, God said that he hated it when people would cause God's people to abhor coming to sacrifice to the Lord. It should be a joyous time. We're worshiping God, and people hate coming to it because they know they're going to get ripped off. And this was a grievous charge that God would hold against Annas. So two ways he would do it. One is that they would come, and the Jews, on their what kind of money did the Jews have? A lot of what they had was Roman coins. Remember, Jesus said, "Bring me a penny. Whose image is on this?" Caesar's. Well, to the Jews, to have Caesar's image on a coin was idolatry. Legally and literally, you know, that they called it that. We don't believe that that's true. You know, we have money with people's, we don't worship that money. But for the Jews, strict observance of the law, they would call that idolatry. So people would come and they'd come to buy their sacrifice. And so Annas and his people would say, "You can't buy it with Roman currency because that's idolatry. You've got to buy it with Jewish currency. Let's do an exchange." And he would totally rip them off in the exchange. The exchange rate was to steal the money. They would use this charge of idolatry to talk the people into doing this, and they knew they were getting ripped off. Another way they'd do it is if somebody brought their lamb or their goat or whatever to offer, it had to be one without blemish. It had to be the very best of their flock. And so people would get the best one and bring it, and they would look at it and look at it very closely and say, no, see, right under there, you know, see really close, you've got to get a microscope, I see a blemish. Your lamb is not good enough. You have to buy our lamb from us. And then they would charge them about three times what the lamb should be, and they would rip people off both ways. So people would say, well, I'm not even going to bring my own lamb because I know they're going to reject it. I'll just show up with my money, and then I have to go to the exchangers. And so anyway, people, they hated going to offer sacrifices now because, or at least to the best, they would do their best to like it, but they knew they're getting ripped off. And this is all Annas' doings. And when Jesus drives them out of the temple, he drives Annas crazy. And so Annas is the chief one that's trying to, and Caiaphas as well, his son-in-law, he's kind of pulling the puppet strings of his son-in-law. So they bring Jesus, first of all, to Annas. It's at night. Look at Luke, well, just listen to it. Luke 22:54, here's where it mentions that it's in his house. Then took they him and led him and brought him into the high priest's house. And Peter followed afar off. Now the high priests here were, they were rich, so their house is not your average house. It was big, it had a courtyard. When we see Peter denying Jesus, this is at Annas' house. You know, in between, he's brought to Annas' house, and then he's taken after Peter denies him to Caiaphas' house. He's got a big courtyard. He's got a gate. A lot of people are there. Jesus is led into the house with the other members of the Sanhedrin there, most of them. And so then they ask him. And remember, we read this last week in John. Let's look at it real fast. This trial before Annas. Let's pick it up in verse 18. John 18:18. And the servants and officers stood there who had made a fire of coals, for it was cold, and they warmed themselves, and Peter stood with them and warmed himself. The high priest then, so this is Annas, the high priest then asked Jesus of his disciples and of his doctrine. And by the way, he's totally going fishing here. He's trying to, he says, tell me, I don't know exactly how he asked it, but tell me all about your disciples. And as he's doing this, let's see if he says something that is a bad thing that I can accuse him of. And well, tell me about your doctrine. I want to hear what you have to say about what you believe. What do you believe about God? What do you believe about heaven? What do you believe about salvation? And he's trying to catch Jesus. And Jesus, knowing that he has no accusation at all, he gives this answer. Verse 20, I spake openly to the world. I ever taught in the synagogue and in the temple, whither the Jews always resort, and in secret have I said nothing. Why askest thou me? Ask them which heard me what I have said unto them. Behold, they know what I said. And there's probably here between verses 21 and 22 this moment of awkward silence that Annas is trying to get something out of Jesus to accuse him, and then Jesus just says, you don't have anything on me, do you? You know, kind of this type of mentality. Not in a, Jesus is not saying this in a scoffing type of way. He's not being disrespectful. But after he says this, he basically embarrasses Annas. You have nothing, there's no charge that I've said. All of my doctrine, if you want to know what I've said, you know, I haven't said it in private. Just ask anyone. They know what I've said. And then Annas is standing like, and then to break the awkward silence, someone comes in and hits Jesus and says, hey, you talked like that to the high priest? And wrongfully hits Jesus. And then Jesus says, if I've spoken evil, bear witness to the evil. But if well, why smitest thou me? Verse 24. Now Annas had sent him bound unto Caiaphas the high priest. So Annas is there and he has nothing. He should be able to drum up some kind of an accusation, but he has nothing to do. So he says, get him out of here. Take him over to Caiaphas. See if Caiaphas can find something. And so Annas is embarrassed by this whole thing. Here's the second trial before Caiaphas, the acting high priest. And they bring him in before Caiaphas, and he's in his house. And this is where, and by the way, we don't see all of it in the book of John. We're not going to compare all the passages. But they begin to bring false witnesses. It says a really interesting thing. We'll talk about false witnesses in just a little bit. We'll get back to it. Let me just walk through these trials really quickly. So he's before Annas, and then Annas sends him to Caiaphas and the Sanhedrin in his house, and they get some proceedings along. And then the third is they send it they in the morning to make this look better on paper. This was secret. Nobody's supposed to know what we're doing. But we need to have a trial that's open. We need to have a trial during the day. So in the morning, we'll go over real fast to the judgment hall. and we'll have a third trial there to make it all legit. Make sure we've got our I's dotted and our T's crossed. That's the third. And then, once they've got their accusation, they condemn him to be guilty of blasphemy. Then they take him over to Pilate and they say, see, he's a blasphemer, he deserves to die. And they hand him over to Pilate. And Pilate, this is the first Roman trial, Pilate can't find anything, so he sends him over to Herod. And we're kind of skipping around. We don't see all this in the book of John, but it's in Matthew and Mark and Luke. Pilate sends him over to Herod, and Herod says, oh, goody, I've heard of a lot. This guy does a lot of miracles. I want to see him do a miracle. And he comes, and there's no miracle, and he can't figure out anything wrong to accuse him of either. So he sends him back over to Pilate, and Pilate the second time gets him. By then, his wife's been told in a dream, have nothing to do with this just man. I've suffered many things in this. You know, God says, leave this guy alone. And Pilate doesn't know what to do. Pilate's getting it from both sides. On one side, God is warning him not to do anything to Jesus. And on the other side, here's what the Jews say. This guy, Jesus, claims to be the king of the Jews. We only have one king, and that's Caesar. And if you let Jesus live, you're not Caesar's friend. We're going to tell on you that you're allowing the Jews to have another king but Caesar. And so Pilate's now between a rock and a hard place. He's getting pressured. Says, okay, fine. I'll wash my hands of it and pretend like I'm not having anything to do with it. And then I'll give him over to the will of the people. And Pilate gives the death sentence. And Pilate's the one who signs the death, you know, the execution letter. The Jews could not have signed it. Pilate agrees to sign it, and so Jesus is killed. So you have six trials that are totally throwing out justice, totally ignoring the established laws. One of the things that they do is they call false witnesses. It was a severe thing in the Jewish law for a false witness to give testimony in trial, for someone to lie under oath. You know, they had certain things that they would say which translate into our society for somebody putting their hand on the Bible, say, I swear to tell the truth, whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help me God. And then people say that and they go out and lie anyway. And that's kind of what happened here. Here's what the Bible says, by the way, about false witnesses. I'm trying to decide if we'll read the whole thing. It's four verses. Here's Deuteronomy 19, 16 through 19. If a false witness rise up against any man to testify against him that which is wrong, then both men, as soon as it's found out, then both men between whom the controversy is shall stand before the Lord, before the priests and the judges, which shall be in those days, and the judges shall make diligent inquisition. They got to figure out what the truth is. And behold, if the witness be a false witness and hath testified falsely against his brother, then shall ye do unto him as he had thought to have done unto his brother. So shalt thou put the evil away from among you. So somebody accuses somebody of murder, and there's a capital offense. This guy murdered this guy, and he turns out to be a lie. You were to kill that guy for making up the law. If you were to accuse somebody and say you were supposed to get a year in prison for whatever crime, if it was a false accusation, he would get the year in prison. And that was a great deterrent against false witnesses. Unless the people that are the judges are in on it, which is what we have here. By the way, wouldn't that be a neat thing to have in our society? Wouldn't that make sure that you have true witnesses, is that anything you accuse somebody of, if it's wrong, you get the same thing done to you. That was God's law that he set up. So they go and they find people that are false witnesses. And it shows their intent, by the way. Look at Matthew chapter 26. We don't see the intent as much in John, but look at Matthew 26, verse 59. Matthew 26, we'll read 59 through 61. It says, now the chief priests and elders and all the council sought false witness against Jesus. You've got all these people. They're not just seeking for witnesses that are against Jesus. They are on purpose seeking liars. They know they cannot convict him according to truth. By the way, this whole thing has to be the most unjust trial in human history, because the only way you convict someone who has never sinned in his life of wrongdoing is to lie about him. That's the only way you crucify the holy, spotless Son of God. You have to lie about him. And so they are seeking false witnesses on purpose to put him to death, but found none. Yea, though many false witnesses came, they found none. And at the last came two false witnesses and said, this fellow said, I am able to destroy the temple of God and to build it in 3 days. And so, by the way, when you have two, when you compare the two accounts, Matthew says this, one, the two witnesses, one says, he said, I am able to destroy this temple, meaning the temple, and build it again in 3 days. That's not what Jesus said at all. He said, if you destroy this temple, meaning his body, then I will build it again in 3 days. They thought he was talking about the temple, but these guys just make up. Jesus never said, I am able to destroy the temple. The other guy, we find in, I think it's in the book of Luke, the other guy says, I will destroy this temple and raise it up in 3 days. So it says that their testimony didn't agree. And by the way, here's what it says in Mark 14:59. They called these two guys, but neither so did their witness agree together. So they're kind of having tryouts. Anybody have a lie you want to tell about Jesus? We'll have open mic, open tryouts. You can come and we'll take the best lie. And this guy gives a lie. No, that didn't work. This guy gives a lie. Finally, they get two guys that almost agree, but they don't agree. And at the end of the whole thing, they say, well, we still can't do anything. By the way, they end up condemning Jesus out of his own mouth. Caiaphas is there and says, these guys say this. And it's not convincing enough. He cannot say, okay, he's guilty of death. He has to ask Jesus, who are you? And for sake of time, I'll just mention, he asks Jesus, are you the Christ, the Son of the Blessed? And Jesus says, I am. And henceforth, ye shall see the Son of Man coming in the clouds of glory. And he says, what need have we of further witnesses? You've heard the blasphemy yourselves. So they don't even convict him by these other witnesses. He claims to be the Son of God on the spot. And he's going to come again and set up his kingdom and come in glory. And they say, see, he's a blasphemer. And they all say he's guilty of death. So the only way they finally convict him is by his own word, his own testimony, which, by the way, as I mentioned, was illegal. Somebody could not convict themselves alone by their own testimony. But that's what they did. Real fast, let me mention this. Here's the hypocrisy of these people. They are left and right throwing out logic and reason and truth and holiness and justice. They've thrown all of it away, and yet they present themselves to have a semblance of holiness. In John 18, verse 28, so back in John 18, here's what it says. It's an interesting little tidbit along the way. John 18, 28, then led they Jesus from Caiaphas unto the hall of judgment, and it was early. And they themselves went not into the judgment hall, lest they should be defiled, but that they might eat the Passover. If we go, and this is a place, the judgment hall, you know, we're not allowed to go in there because then we'll be ceremonially defiled. We won't be able to eat the Passover tomorrow. By the way, remember, they shouldn't be able to eat the Passover anyway tomorrow. They should be fasting after they've accused them of death. But they say, we need to be holy so we can eat the Passover. We need to eat the Lord's Passover tomorrow. So we can't go into the judgment hall. But we can condemn the holy, spotless Son of God and throw justice in the streets. You see the hypocrisy? They're pretending to be holy on one side, but they are as wicked as can be. It says it in Peter. He says, ye have taken him and by wicked hands have crucified and slain him. And Jesus pointed this out, their hypocrisy. We won't read all of it, but in Matthew 23, verses 23 through 28, Jesus, shortly before this, you know, maybe a couple of weeks before, has confronted them, these Pharisees and scribes, and woe unto you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you'll do all these holy things on the outside, and you'll throw mercy and justice and truth into the streets. It mentions a couple of things. You'll tithe. You pay tithe of the smallest things. You know, you'll pay tithe of mint and anise and cumin. If somebody gives you a spice, hey, can I borrow some spice? Okay, let me pull out 10% of these grains and drop them in the offering plate. I mean, they were really meticulous on the outside. And then Jesus says, but you have omitted the weightier matters of the law, judgment, mercy, and faith. He says, you are like whited sepulchres on the outside. You're like an expensive white tomb, which looks really pretty. But on the inside, you've got a dead person rotting and decaying. There's worms crawling in and out. That's what you guys are like on the inside, Jesus says. And he just calls them publicly out for their hypocrisy. Are we ever in this kind of category ourselves? Do we ever in front of other people show ourselves to be holy and righteous, and I would never do something like that. But then when we're privately, or when we're with other people, or when we're in a certain context, we let it all hang out, so to speak, and we're two separate people. We live a double life almost. We're a Dr. Jekyll and a Mr. Hyde. That's what hypocrisy is in the Bible. Remember, the word hypocrite in the, back in these days has to do with an actor. Instead of someone, they would use the word hypocrite freely, you know. Let's go to the movies and watch The Hypocrites. The hypocrite was somebody who would play a part, put on a mask, and pretend to be somebody else for the sake of this play. And Jesus called them, you guys are putting on a mask and pretending to be somebody else. And it's so easy for us to be involved in hypocrisy, isn't it? Because we always want to be thought well of. We might be evil and wicked at times, but we don't want anyone to know about that. So we put on a facade, we put on a front, and we're just like the Pharisees. We may not be unbelievers. We may not be rejecting the Son of God and going to hell and all that, but we can participate in hypocrisy very easily. And by the way, having a desire, I'm not blaming hypocrisy on God's commands, but having God command for us to be holy and us want to be like that and then want to be like that on the outside often becomes an opportunity for hypocrisy. Because, and by the way, what's the alternative to hypocrisy? The alternative to hypocrisy is, when we fall, admitting it. The alternative to hypocrisy is sometimes humiliation. It's sometimes correction, chastening, and we don't want to go down that road. We don't want anyone to find out who we either are consistently or what we have been in a moment, and so we'll do anything to cover it up, and we become hypocrites. And hypocrisy is in more places than just politics. We all know about cover-ups and things like that in politics, but it's in many Christians' lives. It's maybe in all Christians' lives at times. That's one thing we need to watch out about. Jesus says, "Woe unto you that are hypocrites." And so we see these people condemning Jesus, and yet they're pretending to be holy at the same time. Let's skip down to chapter 18 and verse 36. I want to just mention a couple things before we finish, before we close. John 18 and verse 30. Let's go and just jump to verse 36. Remember, they brought Jesus to Pilate, and Pilate says, "What accusation?" Well, take our word for it, he's a malefactor. He's an evildoer. We wouldn't have brought him to thee. Verse 36, Jesus answered, "My kingdom is not of this world. If my kingdom were of this world, then would my servants fight that I should not be delivered to the Jews. But now is my kingdom not from hence." Jesus says, a lot of people are expecting me to be as the Messiah, to set up my kingdom and take over, put down Rome, deliver the Jews right now. He says, that's not what I came to do. My kingdom is a spiritual kingdom. By the way, as Christians, we are part of that kingdom. If you're saved today, you are in his kingdom. And his kingdom is still not of this world. Jesus is not grasping for power now in this world. He's not grasping for respect in this world. He was willing to be humiliated. He's not grasping for relevance in this world. He's not grasping for money and possessions and fame and all the things of the world. That's the kingdom that is of this world. Jesus says that our kingdom is from above. Our citizenship, our home, is in heaven. This world is not my home. I'm just passing through. And we need to be reminded of this statement day by day in our Christian lives, that Jesus' kingdom, which we are a part of, is not of this world. There's nothing wrong with having this world's goods as long as we use it for God's glory. It is a sin to have this world's goods and trust in them and chase after them and even put God on the back burner because of the things of this world. That's what God condemns. The love of money, the Bible says, is the root of all evil, which some have coveted after, have erred from the faith and pierced themselves through with many sorrows. What's the end result of somebody that has to have more, that has to have more money, more power, more fame and position? The end result is that there's nothing stopping them. They err from the faith. They're willing to compromise truth, and they pierce themselves through with many sorrows. It's a miserable person. Find the person that's covetous and has to have more, and that's a person who will end in misery and sorrow. Many sorrows. And so Jesus says, my kingdom is not of this world. We've got to remind ourselves, it's okay if I don't have as much money or the same position or whatever else that we chase after. We compare ourselves. We keep up with the Joneses. It's okay if I don't have that. Jesus didn't even have a place to put his head. Foxes have holes. Birds have nests. But the Son of Man doesn't even have a place to lay his head. And so he said that to people that were thinking about following him. You know, just reevaluate this. Are you willing to follow me and not have much in this life? That might be what it is. There may be, you know, Abraham and Job were people who believed in God and they were very rich. There's nothing wrong with that. But it may be that God calls us to less. And by the way, here's a balance. I wouldn't say that God has called all Christians to poverty. You have to sell everything that you have and you feel guilty if you ever enjoy something in this life. God has given us all things richly to enjoy, right? So we've got to have the balance. We're not supposed to sell everything and go live under a bridge. That doesn't please God. Pleasing God is following him and seeking after him, seeking after the kingdom of God and his righteousness, and all these things will be added unto us. That's a tough balance, isn't it, to get between the two, to be in the world and live among the things of the world and not desire them. We've got to stay close to God. And so remind ourselves of this thought every day. God's kingdom is not of this world. If it were, I would gather the soldiers to fight. And say, in fact, he said, I could call 12 legions of angels, which would be about 144,000 angels. I could have them here in a moment. They could wipe everybody out. Remember, one angel by himself killed 185,000 Syrians one night. So imagine what 144,000 angry angels could do. Jesus says, I could call them at any moment, but I'm not. I'm going to leave all that now because my kingdom is not of this world. What I'm here to do right now is lay down my life. And even though, and by the way, these angels are mad because they see all these injustices. They see you throwing God's word out the window and accusing me of things wrongly. They're angry, but I'm holding them back right now because I've come to lay down my life. He says, the reason that I came, well, then kind of with verse 37 here. Pilate therefore said unto him, art thou a king then? Jesus said, thou sayest that I am a king. To this end was I born, and for this cause came I into the world, that I should bear witness unto the truth. Everyone that is of the truth heareth my voice. He came, when you combine that thought with other places, he came not to be ministered unto, but to minister and to give his life a ransom for many. These are synonyms. He says, the reason I came was to bear witness to the truth. And the reason I came was to give my life a ransom for many. You put those two together, and what you get is, he bore witness to the truth that his death is what saves. And if people will believe in that and come to him, that is why he was born. For this purpose was I born. And so I'm not going to try to save myself in this moment. I'm not going to, we talked about this a couple of weeks ago. I'm not going to try to get servants together and deliver me from Rome. I'm handing myself over to Rome so that I can bear witness to the truth. And the truth, the bottom, the overarching and fundamental foundational truth in all of life is the way to have joy and peace and eternal life and be with God forever is to believe in Jesus. That's what Jesus came to do. And these people, because they've rejected it, they just want to hold on to their power. Again, Annas, he's losing his power. Jesus is coming in. He's taking away his money from the money changers. He's turning people away from him. They're afraid all people are going to go after Jesus. We've got to stop it at all costs. And so you have this great unjust series of trials. They had six trials. By the way, you know, in our society, they say that the wheels of justice grind very slowly. I read a statistic that I think San Francisco, of every city in the nation, San Francisco has the slowest judicial system. It takes, I forget the number, months and months and months to get through a trial. They banged six trials out in one day, in half a day, condemned them to death, judge, jury, executioner, and all of it was a travesty of justice. And Jesus allowed it. I want to end with this thought. Are we willing to be mistreated for the cause of Christ? What if we were in a situation where this were to happen in the United States of America, in a judicial system that prides itself on fairness and justice? What if this were to happen to someone? What if it were to happen to you? Would we pull out all the stops? This is wrong. We've got to take to Facebook and Twitter, and we've got to get the word out that justice has fallen in the streets. Would we trust in God? Jesus says, I commit my soul unto thee. I let God handle the way this is going to play out. Or would we fight? Jesus says, my servants, are not going to fight because my kingdom is not of this world. But if we're there, we're going to fight. We're going to do anything we can to make sure that we get justice, that we get what we deserve. My rights are being trampled on. That's the cry of the world today. Nobody's going to trample on my rights. I have my civil liberties. I'm going to hire the American Civil Liberties Union to take up my cause, and nobody will ever allow themselves to have their rights trampled on. As Christians, are we willing, it says in 1 Corinthians 6, are we willing to allow ourselves to be defrauded? Or do we have to take somebody to court because my rights have been trampled on? Are we willing, like Jesus, to trust in God to handle our affairs? Psalm 31:10, David said, "My times are in thy hand. I'm going to let you handle it." But we've got to fight against it. And not, by the way, not just court, but we fight against it in our interpersonal lives, in our day-by-day relationships. This person's not going to say this behind my back. I'm going to make sure everyone knows what they did. And in our homes, in our families, I'm going to make sure that everything is always, that I get what is fair. I'm never going to be mistreated. And Jesus was more mistreated than anyone in the history of the world, and he allowed it. And he prayed for them, "Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do." But he never fought against it. What a tall order to live up to. And then after all that is said and done, he says, "I've given you an example that you should do the same thing." Jesus wants us to trust in God to run our lives, to handle. Whenever we're offended, why don't we pray and say, "God, you take care of it. Don't get vengeance." Joseph is a good example. He says, "Am I in the place of God? Am I going to take God's place and get vengeance? Or am I just going to leave it in God's hands and let God work it all out?" That is easier said than done. I don't hold myself up as an example in this area and say, "Follow me because I never do this." But this is what Jesus did, and this is what he calls us to do. Suffer ourselves to be defrauded. No one was ever defrauded greater than Jesus was on this night. And he's an example for us. Let's pray.